welcome to the Frontside Podcast. I am Charles Lowell, and with me is Robert DeLuca, and we have a very special guest this week, one that I'm really excited about because the things she says and the ideas that she has open eyes and minds all over the place in all different types of areas and are so pertinent to the way we do our jobs. So we'll get to it. Our guest today is Sarah May.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Like I said, we are super excited to have you here. So, but before we get started talking about some of the things that you've been thinking about recently, why don't you just give like a very brief introduction of how you got started with development, where you've been, and how's that brought you to where you're going right now?
I actually was not one of these people that got started with it real early. I came to programming in college. I was an engineering major. I wanted to build bridges. I wanted to be a structural engineer. I wanted to build things. And I had a weird schedule the first couple of quarters of college, though. And so I ended up taking an elective earlier than most people take it. It was a programming class in Fortran that was required for the structural engineering program. And I took that class and I was like, this is really cool.
Wait, Fortran is what set the hook?
Yeah. And the professor of the class was like, well, if you think Fortran is cool, I've got some other stuff that you might like. But what I mean, the language and whatever doesn't really matter. What I liked about it was the fact that I could build something. I could get that same feeling of building something that you get if you build a bridge, but you can do more than like one or two in your career, like you do if you're a structural engineer. And so I liked the constant feeling of building. That's what I liked about it. And so I ended up switching my major and graduating with a CS degree and coming out and doing a bunch of different things, mostly at like starting at a large company and then sort of doing smaller and smaller companies over time.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of people in the industry who are like career switchers, where they started out in something else and moved into computer science. But I actually feel that a lot of people, like myself included, you know, I have a degree in CS too, but that was not what I set out to do at all. It totally derailed like the course of my life in a good way. But in that way, it's like a career switch within a career switch.
I'm a little odd in that aspect. I came out of high school like ready to go in software, and it worries me a little bit for the later half of my life. Like, am I going to do software for the entire time?
Probably not.
That might be a good thing. You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously, what lays ahead? Who knows?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of places that are in like, for example, in public policy and in other places where we need more people that understand tech. So if we can send you out into other parts of the world knowing a whole lot about programming, like that can only be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is actually kind of funny. I was telling Charles about this the other day. Is like I'm starting to view programming more as a tool to do the things that I really want to do and less as like the thing that I'm going to be doing forever. I want it to augment and make things that I'm passionate about easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's like software is eating the world. So what you're doing now is just learning how to chew.
That's a great way to put it.
You should tweet that.
All right. Please continue. I'll be ignore the typing sounds.
Switching careers is a really interesting thing because you end up with a bunch of experience that you wouldn't have had otherwise. I'm really excited actually about the next 5 years as we have all these folks that switched into programming from something else who are all becoming mid to senior level because they're bringing just such amazing experience from other parts of the world.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, where you guys been all my whole career?
Right.
It's like you understand these things just like almost like it's second nature, these things that are opaque and completely inaccessible to me. So anyhow.
So that's how I got here.
So then after you kind of switched in college, you went out and did you just start working in programming immediately thereafter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked at a bunch of different product companies. I built products for a while. My first job actually out of college was at Microsoft up in Redmond. And then I have worked at smaller and smaller and smaller companies. And then I spent about 10 years doing product stuff. And then about 10 years ago, I switched into doing consulting, mostly because I realized that I have a fairly short attention span for projects and that working on a product, there wasn't anything wrong with me exactly. But what would happen is if I was working on a product, I would get 6 months to a year into it. And I would start to get antsy. I'd start to get bored and decided that I should just embrace that and switch to something where I am going to be on a new project every 3 to 6 months. And I've been a lot happier since then.
That's interesting. I wonder if that comes with seniority in software development and knowing your way around. Because consulting for me is I've gotten the experience of, oh, wow, I'm just finally getting a hang of like this person's product or this client's product or app or whatever we're building. And it's like, all right, time to rotate off. It's like you're just getting there and understanding everything.
there is that aspect of it for sure. But even when I was much less experienced, even in my first couple of jobs, I noticed this tendency in myself to just get bored after 6 months on the same code base. For a long time, I thought it was because I'm not cut out for software, or maybe I'm not very good at it or something. And eventually I just realized, no, actually, it's just that I need to switch projects. I'm just one of those people. That's how my brain works. And I get a lot out of switching projects, because the one that I switch onto, I see like an entirely different way of doing things. Like, code bases are so different. Even if you look at 100 different Rails apps or 100 different Ember apps, like, they're all so different. So switching onto somebody else's app, I learn a ton just out of that switching process.
It sounds like the actual kind of studying the meta level of the software is what really engages you, and kind of understanding how the software came to be the way it is and not some other way. And what are the factors that gave rise to that? And kind of that's the problem that, you know, really sunk its teeth into you, as opposed to the individual business problem. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly been interesting to see different business problems and to understand different parts of industries and so on. That's definitely part of it for me. But what really gets me interested is the different ways that people organize their code and like how they make the decisions that they make.
Yeah, you get to see like different problems that they've maybe put themselves into because of the way they structured something, which you wouldn't see if you wrote yourself, but somebody else did it. And you get to see, oh, I understand this pattern now. That's kind of been my experience. I don't want to speak for you, but yeah, that's kind of how I've seen other client projects. Like, whoa, this is really cool. I didn't think of a way to do this. And then you get to experience many different things in many different ways.
Yeah, you get to see a lot of the trade-offs. Like, a lot of times in a single code base, what would happen is I'd make a decision, or, you know, we'd make a design decision of some kind, and then I'd see how it turned out. But like, there's no way for me to see how it would have turned out if I did it the other way, right? And the nice thing about switching projects for me is just being able to see all of those trade-offs. Like, the trade-offs that you make tend to be pretty similar, right? So you can see very similar situations where people do different things, and how does it turn out for them?
Right. And like, one of my favorite things is where you go into a project totally against something. Like, for me, it was object-oriented CSS. And then you go in and you actually see it in practice, and you're like, oh, wow, this has turned a whole new light on it. I like this in this case.
Yeah, microservices are like that for me, where it's like generally I'm anti like microservice bandwagon. But then I went on one project where I was like, wow, they actually figured it out. This works really well. I can see why people like it, because I had just seen so many where it was horribly executed. But then you go on to one where it's good and you're like, oh, this is why people do that. Okay.
Yeah, it's like that light bulb. You're like, oh, yep, there is another side to this.
Once you actually see it done right, it helps you avoid every other situation where it was done wrong. You can say, oh, this is like the tiny little, this was the one differentiator that made it all go right. Sometimes it doesn't always boil down to that, but here's these 1, 2, 3 things that we could have done, you know, but they were just completely and totally hidden from you because you didn't have that context. I'd love to talk to you about microservices, because I've certainly never seen it done right. I've heard it talked about, and I've seen this beautiful world and picture painted that looks so, so fantastic on the whiteboard. But I certainly...
Oh, it's so beautiful, isn't it? It's like an object-oriented design diagram. You're like, look at all the boxes and lines, and they all line up. And I can do it in Visio, and they all like line. They're the same shape. This is great.
Mm-hmm. And when I move this one over there, it just tells me that these two are exactly the same distance apart from that other one. Ah, so satisfying.
Yeah, and then you try and do it is the problem.
And then you build it and you cross your arrows and everything.
Which actually, I think that brings us, you recently, you know, we're talking on Twitter, I think actually very recently, about kind of the difference between when we talk about software and the meta conversations we have around it, when we do talk about these abstract and perfect worlds of boxes and lines versus the actual code bases, which is the things that you've kind of been observing many, many, many since you started consulting, and kind of divide between those and, you know, what that means. And I think a lot of people aren't even self-aware. Like, I certainly, before kind of reading that, wasn't really aware that that is a very, very distinct difference. Like, these are two very different modes for software, one that exists and one that's this kind of perfect world.
Kind of like academia versus the real world, I guess.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in college, we had a software design class as part of our degree program. And so we studied how you define objects, and we, you know, wrote a little bit of UML, and like, we did all this stuff. And when I got out and I got into the real world and I had a job, I found it very difficult to actually apply that stuff successfully, to be able to draw a diagram and then turn it into code and have it work out the way that the diagram said it was supposed to work out. And I initially thought that was because I was just not experienced enough to figure it out. But eventually what I realized is that it doesn't work because it doesn't work. because it really doesn't work to design things ahead of time and then just do them. I think there might be a certain type of person that can do that. I am not that type of person. And most people aren't. I think that it takes a very unusual type of brain to be able to just like draw a diagram that has already taken into account all of the things you're going to encounter once you start making it.
Yeah, I would even go so far as to say that it's probably a brain that solved that problem many, many times and just can skip a bunch of steps.
Right, and they're not aware they're skipping them necessarily.
Right.
And unless you have an entire team full of that type of brain, it's probably not a good idea in general for the software that you're building as a group. And I feel like I've been trying to talk about that concept between the difference of how we talk about software in books and in blogs and in conference talks, and then how we build the software we actually build for, like, I feel like I've been trying to articulate that for 20 years, like since I had my first job. And I was like, this doesn't work. Why can't I make a diagram and then make it into code, right? So like 2 days ago, I feel like I finally found a way to articulate it that captures everything that I've been trying to communicate. And it was a really strange feeling. I'm like, wow, I finally kind of got it. And one of the reasons that I came up with it, I think, is because I haven't really been thinking about it for a couple of months. I've been off not really thinking about software stuff for a while. Oddly enough, I've been thinking about organizing my house for the last like 3 months. All of my free time outside of my job has been thinking about like, okay, like I've been learning how to cook. So how can I organize my kitchen so that like the things I actually use every day, I don't have to dig through a drawer every single time to find them. And there's actually some interesting problems there of like, how do I make sure that all of the stuff that I need is at hand, that I use all the time, all the stuff that I need occasionally is like still around and accessible. And then the things that I don't use, I should probably just get rid of. And I have this problem that I think probably a lot of people have, which is that I have trouble getting rid of stuff once I have it. And I live in a small apartment in San Francisco, and that's not a good thing to be able to unable to get rid of things, because in an apartment this size, like, I can let it go for a week or two, maybe, but like, I got to be very vigilant about it, because otherwise it just overwhelms the space.
Yeah, there's a bunch of like research that the people estimate vastly different the cost of acquisition versus the cost of loss. And they put way too much, like an irrationally unbalanced, like not wanting to lose something that they already have.
Even if I bought it for a need I don't have anymore, or if the need has changed or shifted, like I don't buy things I don't need. Like there are some people that have that problem, that they buy a bunch of stuff that they don't have any particular plans for. I don't have that problem. Thankfully, I've had people in my family that had that problem, which is, I think, why I have avoided that. But the problem I have is that once something is here, I find it very difficult to get rid of it. I look at it and I'm like, I can think of all these reasons why I shouldn't get rid of it. Oh, well, that was expensive, right? So the sunk cost fallacy of like, oh, I paid a lot of money for that. Even if it's not useful and I don't like it, I shouldn't get rid of it. Or there'll be like a dress in my closet I haven't worn for 2 years. And I'm like, maybe I should get rid of it. And I take it out and I'm like, oh, but it looks really good on me. I like it. I should wear this. I should really wear this. So I'm going to keep it, even though I haven't worn it for 2 years for some reason, but I should keep it anyway because it looks good. Right. And so I have all of these stories that I tell myself about why I can't get rid of things. And a couple of weeks ago, I read a book or I read part of a book, to be totally honest with you, called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. It was written by this woman from Japan who's a professional organizer. Her name is Marie Kondo. And her method is called KonMari. And basically what it does is when you're trying to figure out whether you should get rid of something, you don't ask yourself, should I keep it? What you ask yourself is, does this thing bring me joy? And if it brings me joy, then I keep it. And if it doesn't, then I'm going to get rid of it. And so that made it really easy coming back to like the dress example. I'm like, does this dress give me joy? And I thought about it and I was like, no, the reason I don't like it, I don't wear it, is because, you know, I went out to dinner and had like a bad experience at dinner. And so now every time I look at that dress, it reminds me of that experience. And so it looks good and everything, but I'm not going to wear it because it doesn't make me happy. Mm. And so that, it was just like, okay, fine. I'm just going to give it away. And it, changing that question that I ask away from should I keep it towards how does it make me feel was a huge change for me, because it's like, oh, okay, well, that's really easy to answer, right? Whereas should I keep it is a much harder question with a bunch of sort of ifs and maybes and what ifs and what happens. And I feel like that applying this KonMari question to stuff has changed the way that I calculate what stays and what goes in a very positive way.
Yeah, boy, I need to get this book for several family members who will go unnamed.
Well, and I've got two kids, and so there's a constant flow of stuff coming into the house.
Yeah.
And so there has to be, because of the amount of space I have, there has to be a constant flow of stuff going out. And so this is something I just need to be very vigilant about. And this has made it so that it takes up a lot less of my time and a lot less of my brain space, which is really awesome. And it feels like it's moving my house in the right direction. I've been thinking about that sort of in various ways on and off for a couple of months, and I haven't been thinking about software. And so I had this fear that like maybe that means I'm never going to think about software again. Like I go through these phases where I've got like, oh, I'm going to come up with a bunch of new ideas. Where I'm coming up with new ideas for some whatever reason. And I'm, you know, maybe I'm making new conference talks. I'm doing stuff and I'm thinking about software a lot. And then I go through these phases where I don't do that. Like I sort of retrench and maybe, I don't know, like I think about other stuff for a while. And so it's been home organization for several months. And I was like, this, I'm never going to think about software again. This is it. It's over. I've peaked. You know?
Career change.
Oh man, this sounds so much like my life since I moved out to Austin.
And, you know, I live in San Francisco and I'm not 25, I'm 40. And so like, it's, you know, a lot of it is like, maybe I'm just too old for software now. I should just give up and, you know, live out the rest of my career doing quiet maintenance work somewhere. <Whoa. I don't> And then suddenly this, like, this thing happened on Monday where it was just like, oh, code and organization and boom. And there it was. And I realized that like, I basically just had to give my brain some time off. Like my conscious brain needed some time off from software. And it wasn't that it had disappeared, because what I came up with on Monday was really just like how home organization applies to code. Because I realized that the feelings that I get when I'm trying to figure out what I should do with code are very similar to the feelings that I get when I'm trying to figure out whether I should get rid of a thing, right? I look at this piece of code and I'm like, should I change this? Should I get rid of it? Should I refactor it? And you're like, well, I can't get rid of that. We just spent 2 weeks refactoring it, so I can't change it again.
Yeah.
Right? Or like, we just put in a story for refactoring this and we spent 3 days and I can't go back to the product people and tell them I need to change it more. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I really like this code because I wrote it with someone that I really liked. And so,
so I don't want to get rid of it.
I don't want to get rid of it because then I would lose the memory of working with, you know, I mean.
That is, I actually can say that I've experienced that.
Yeah. There's a lot of reasons why you don't want to change code. What I was thinking about, like, is maybe we're asking the wrong question in the same way that should I keep this is the wrong question when you're talking about stuff. Maybe should I change this is the wrong question when you're talking about code, right? Maybe it's sort of leading you in the same way that with stuff that leads you down this conversation of like reasons that don't really have anything to do with the essential quality of why the code is there or why the thing is there. We need something that helps us reassess our needs, right? So if our needs have changed, maybe you don't need that thing anymore because your needs have changed. And the same way with code, right? If your needs have changed, maybe you don't need that code anymore, at least not in the form that it's at now. So I think that question for code, instead of does it bring me joy, because joy is not something that I think is concrete enough when we're talking about code. I think the question for code is, do I understand this? Do I understand what it's doing? And not just understand it like a very at the surface level of like, can I figure out what the syntax means? But understand more at like the grok level, right? Of like, I understand this at a very deep level. I understand why it's here. I understand what problem it's solving. I understand why this abstraction is necessary. I understand how it got here.
Yeah, how it fits into the bigger picture.
How it fits into the bigger picture, exactly, of the application.
How it fits in with, like, our conventions that are just purely stylistic.
How does it fit in with the other stuff that we've been doing? How does it fit in with the product needs and the features we're trying to build and the business goals and all of that stuff, all of these different levels of understanding of why this code is here and what it does?
Mm-hmm. Do other team members' understanding factor into that? Like, do I understand the way that other people understand it, so to speak?
I think that it can, but I think that the important thing is whether you personally understand it.
Okay,
right?
So you think it's a very personal, like, it's a very personal decision.
I think it is. Hopefully what you do is you want different people looking at the same code. You don't want just one person sort of on a piece of code that no one else ever sees, whether it's pairing or there's code review or whether it's something else. It needs to be really clear to someone coming in, looking at that code, what it does and what it means and why it's there.
Right. I guess the reason I ask the question is because a lot of times when I look at a piece of code, I try and really step outside of myself and say, what will someone else think who has never been on this project before or who is on this project and they see this code? Will they understand it?
Absolutely. I think that's definitely part of it when you're on a team.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to figure out how that question factors into this framework.
Yeah. I think that it depends a lot on how you distribute tasks. So for example, if you work in a shop where you're pair programming most of the time, so that there's always two people looking at a piece of code. Do I understand this is a reasonable question just for the two of you to consider, right? Both from the fact that you can pool your knowledge, but also from the fact of like, okay, like, are there pieces of this that you understand that I don't understand, and vice versa, right? On the other hand, if you work in a shop where it's more like, here's the piece of code that you work on, like you own this section of code, then I think it's more important for you to be able to, you know, step outside and be like, okay, do I understand this? Would other people on my team understand this? That can be a very difficult thing to assess. And that's where I think it's very helpful to do things like code reviews, to, you know, call people in and be like, hey, can I run some stuff by you? I'm trying to figure out if this is good or not. Because what you want is you want a code base that is comfortable and understandable for you and for your team. And just like the thing that makes the KonMari method powerful for stuff is that it doesn't tell you what you're going to end up with. It doesn't tell you what level of clutter versus cleanliness is good for you, right? It doesn't tell you here, you either want to, you know, end up like something in one of these Simple Living magazines, right? Or end up at like something on from like Hoarders, the TV show, right? Like there's somewhere in the middle. There's a bunch of places in the middle that are all fine. Everyone's going to fall somewhere differently along that line. And so I've managed, now that I've thought about this a lot, to set up my kitchen in a way that is very comfortable for me. Like I know where things are. I can find them really easily. Things that I use are at hand. But other people come in and they're just like, I have no idea where anything is, right? Like it's very personal. The organizational system you end up with and the level of clutter that you have is a very personal thing. And that's why if you look at something like staged houses, right? So you're selling your house. And so you hire someone to put in rugs and furniture and stuff and make it look like somebody lives there so that people can walk in and sort of imagine themselves in the space. They don't put any of that clutter into the staging, right? They don't put any books on the coffee table except for, you know, like big picture books, right? Right. They don't leave the remote controls on the couch. You know, there's no plunger by the toilet. There's no like
Legos on the floor. Yeah.
Everything that looks good.
Everything that makes it more personal, they leave out because it looks like somebody else's mess. You go into something like that and you're like, this is not my mess. This is somebody else's mess. This can't possibly be my house and I'm not going to buy it.
Oh, do we do this for software in conference talks and posts?
Absolutely, yeah. We do. Yeah. You know, and that sounds very similar, right? For someone, when you get someone new onto a project, especially if they're more senior and they'll walk in and be like, this, I can't live like this. You know, this is somebody else's mess. And clearly we need to make some changes, right? But that's the reason why they leave it out of the staged houses, right? It's because you want people to be able to imagine their own level of clutter and disorganization superimposed on this skeleton.
Right.
But real life is not that, right? Real life is somewhere between that and Hoarders.
Right.
And there's a very interesting parallel there with code, right? Which is like, when we look at code from, like, if we, you know, you look at the object-oriented design textbooks, so you look at conference talks, you look at blog posts, sample code, it's all very staged house, right? It's very uncomplicated. It has no clutter in it. And that's because you're supposed to be able to look at that.
Nor could it, really. I mean, it's that clutter can distract from the sales process, so to speak.
Exactly, right? Like, they have an idea they're trying to get across.
Right.
And the clutter would distract people from the idea. But the problem there is the same with the staged house, which is that it's very difficult to tell what it will be like once you move in. And it's very difficult to take some of these ideas that you see demonstrated in these staged environments and take them and apply them to your code base, which is probably closer to a hoarded house than to a staged house, right? Especially if it's a code base that's existed for a while over time, that has been worked on by lots of different people. You know, this is a problem that I've noticed with a lot of, like, there are some really amazing books about software design that have come out in the last couple of years. Of course, Sandy Metz's book is at the top of my list. But the thing that people have trouble with, like, they love the book. They love the book. I love the book. But then they find it very difficult to apply those principles when they sit down in front of a code base that has already been worked on for 6 or 7 years, in some cases, by maybe 50 different people, mm-hmm. Who knows, over time. How do you take those principles and start applying them like in a way that moves you in the right direction, right? And that's where people are just like, I can't do this. I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. And it's very similar to a problem where you've got a very dirty house and you don't know where to start in order to move it towards something that's more like something from the Simple Living magazines, right? Or like more like a staged house. Like you don't know how to start to get it in that direction. And so you just kind of give up.
Mm-hmm.
And the powerful thing about KonMari is it doesn't give you like, here's what you're going to end up with, but it gives you a way to get started on something that gives you a very easy question to answer. And it moves you in the right direction. It moves your house in the right direction without being overly prescriptive about what you'll end up with.
Yeah, what that direction even is.
And what you'll end up with is personal for you anyway. And so I think the question about do I understand this code is similarly helpful in that it moves you, your code base, in the right direction without necessarily giving you a lot of prescription about how you do it or where it goes or even where it's going to end up. It just gives you a question to ask that's like, okay, it tells you whether or not this code needs to change. And the question just is, do I understand it? If I don't, it should probably change. And if I do, okay, we can just kind of leave it for now.
So now if you're working on a team where you have two different people, maybe of different skill levels, you know, maybe just of a different temperament or a different set of preferences, what do you do when the answer to that question is two different things for two different people?
Well, it's sort of like when you move in with someone, right? Like, this is the hard part about living with somebody else, is that you have to mutually agree upon a method of keeping your house that is agreeable to both of you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when they say that, like, you know, working in a startup is like being married to someone, there's some elements of that, right? Because you basically have to figure out, like, okay, we're going to live in this code together. And so if we're going to live in this code together, we better both be happy with it. How can we both be happy with it?
Right.
Right. And that involves usually some compromise. Like, I really hate doing the dishes, but I don't mind cooking, or and vice versa. You know, so you have to like figure out, it really bothers me when there's socks on the floor, but I don't care if you leave dirty dishes in the sink or whatever it is. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you just have to have these conversations about like what is going to make the code livable for you. And you basically want to end up with a code base that's understandable, where all parts of it are understandable to everyone on the team. Now, that's like an ideal, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to get there, but that's kind of what you're going for. So if you have two people in the code and you have disagreements about what is the right way to go, sometimes it can help to just be like, hey, I don't really understand this, versus I don't think this is the right decision, right? And here's why. Here's why I don't understand this. And sometimes reframing the question in that way can prompt them to communicate reasons that they have for doing this that they maybe weren't able to articulate before, for example. Hmm. And just like when you move in with someone, you need to have sort of this commitment to finding a level of housekeeping that you're both happy with. When you're working on a team, you do have to have sort of a mutual commitment to having a code base that everyone can live in.
Right. I like that, because having like, I just don't understand this and here's the reason why, you know, that being a completely and totally valid answer, because, you know, sometimes in a code base, whether someone's brand new or maybe they're at a more junior level and they don't quite have the tools to understand it, or there's a lot of steps they haven't yet taken, it's like understanding is not going to be accessible to them immediately.
And maybe that means that's the wrong decision for that code base then, right?
Right.
Because, like, if something is abstracted to the point that a lot of people on the team don't get it, mm-hmm. then it's probably not the right abstraction for that code base.
Right.
That abstraction might be totally appropriate in a code base in which you've got folks that are more experienced.
Yeah.
Who understand why it's there, who have, you know, have the scars from previous times when they didn't do it, et cetera, et cetera. And they understand why it's there. Because there's sort of like intellectual understanding of like, yes, object-oriented design is a good thing. And then there's, I would call it almost emotional understanding of like, oh yeah, there's this time that we didn't do that and that worked out badly for us, right? I think that folks that don't have the sort of experiential understanding, sometimes they just need to have that, right? They need to get that. And sometimes what that means is you want to let them see what happens, like to a certain extent, right? Let them see what happens when you don't do that.
Right. I mean, this reminds me actually of, I've got three kids, and you know, the way our house is now versus the way it was 7 years ago is wildly different, the way that we lived. And you know, with our first child, I'm ashamed to admit it, like our strategy was just to kind of put safety locks all over everything, every cabinet, on the oven, not on the refrigerator, but just kind of, you know, quote unquote, childproof the house. But that was really so that we wouldn't have to change the way that we lived. But it made the house really uncomfortable for our children. And kind of having observed that over, you know, the course of having the second and the third, it's now there's not anything that we childproof really. We put like the dangerous chemicals like way up high where only we can get them. So it's a little bit more inconvenient if, you know, we need to access the bleach. But that's something that level of discomfort is something that we live with. And, you know, we've always got cups that are set out on, we have a cabinet that sits below the counter. So we've got like water cups set out so that the children can get water and stuff anytime that we want. And we try and, you know, for things that they're going to need, make sure that it's like accessible if you happen to be 4 feet shorter. That's just a condition of who you are. And so it means like the actual configuration of our house, even though it's the same house, is just radically different. And it is more optimized, or it's optimized as a compromise for the fact that, you know, there are people living in this house now that haven't learned how to operate everything. And but they just need to learn that the oven is hot and you don't go there. Rather than slapping a lock on it.
Your house is probably more comfortable for you as a group.
Yes.
Right? And what that means is that as, quote unquote, the senior in the house, right, it's less comfortable for you in some ways.
Yes.
But it's worth it. It's worth being less comfortable for you in order to increase comfort across the board for everyone in the household.
Right. Because it means that if the child needs water, I don't have to stop what I'm doing to get a cup out of the cabinet and fill it for them.
Well, and they feel agency over the stuff. In their house, right? They feel like they live there, like the house is for them.
Yes.
Yeah, it builds comfort and confidence.
Yeah, I think that's a very good analogy. Anytime you have a group of people living together, everyone makes compromises in order for the house to be set up in the way that's optimized for the group.
Yeah, so man, how are we going to apply this to software? What's the next step? Like, what are the concrete steps? I guess it's just asking those questions, like asking the did I understand it?
It is asking those questions, and it's also, if you are one of the more experienced folks on the team, it's your job to elicit the answers to that from other people that are less experienced. Like, they're not going to tell you. A lot of times, sometimes, they're not even going to, they're, you know, they may or may not feel comfortable saying that they don't understand something, right? And so it's your job to really try and figure out, like, do they get this at a level that is acceptable, right? Like, do they understand why this abstraction is here? At an intellectual level or at an experiential level, at an emotional level, do they get it? Which is not something you can really just ask, right? In many cases, it's your job to
just observe it.
To observe and to see how it works. Like if people are having a hard time understanding where things are in the code base, it could be because everything is so cluttered that you can't see anything. Or it could be that everything is so hidden that you can't see anything. Right? Is it sort of the staged house equivalent where everything is too abstracted? Or is it the hoarded house equivalent where everything is just obscured and under piles of junk? And either way, no matter which direction you need to move towards the middle, the question is always, do I understand this?
Right.
I like this a lot. I keep on coming to the analogy of like, if you put a chef in a different kitchen where everything is just totally rearranged and they don't know where their knives are, where their measuring cups are and stuff. I think that plays perfectly into software of like you put somebody into a code base that they don't know and all right, now figure it out. It's not their home. It's not what they're comfortable with or used to. Yeah. I think this is making my brain work on how I can apply this. Yeah.
Well, and if they're moving in, right? Like if, when you hire somebody and they quote unquote move into your house, you need to be ready for things to change. And this is one of the reasons why I've been saying for many years in ways that I think maybe didn't quite connect as well as they could have, that really the team is the code and vice versa, right? Like every time you add someone to the team or someone leaves the team, like teams are not mutable, right? You get a completely new team. And so it's not like you can just sort of carry on like you did before. Every time you get someone new onto the team, everything gets reimagined. Every breakdown of responsibility, every decision, you look at it in a new way when you have someone new come on to the team. And if they're going to stay, right, like if, for in your chef example, right, if this person is moving in and this is going to be their kitchen and they're sharing it with other people, then what you're going to end up with is probably something in between what it is when they get there and what they had before, right? Like they're going to bring in some ideas, you're going to keep some of your ideas, and you're going to end up with something in the middle. And the same thing has to happen with your code when you bring someone new onto the team.
I really like the way that this just focuses the discussion, you know, and I know that you've talked about this a lot before, whether it's a kitchen or a house, this idea of the code not being so much, you know, this shrink-wrapped product. It's a structure, yes. It is definitely that, but it's a structure that you as people inhabit. And, you know, it protects you from certain things and it provides you certain things that you need to live. When, you know, people ask us, why is a continuous delivery pipeline so important and automating all these things for deploying your software, it's because the idea is that this is going to be a living thing that you are, your team will actually be living in. And every member of that team will be living in from the time they start with the company or start with the project until the time that they exit and the time that they leave. And it's the actual living process that you want to make comfortable and pleasant.
And that what comfortable and pleasant means will be different depending on who's on that team, right?
Yes,
like it's not
absolutely.
Something that is a,
it's not
that you can have like a, Right. I mean, this is why all of these things of like, here's how you design things always seem to fall flat, because like I think it would be better titled like, here's how I did one thing once. Right. Or here's what works for me. Like, I feel like every conference talk that is about design could be
this,
here's
was
what
awesome
works for me. I did this one thing once. And
you might want to try it.
You could try it. It might work for you, but it might not. Right. A lot of times where conference talks fall flat and blog posts and everything else is where they're more like, this is how you do it. This is the mm-hmm. right way to do it.
Right.
And you're like, well, I mean, it certainly worked for you.
Right.
The one time I gave a conference talk, the night before, I went through every slide and scrutinized it as much as I thought somebody out in the public would do it. And I think that's might be where like we go through and quote unquote stage our code. It's like we're trying to make it perfect for somebody that might come through and scrutinize it or criticize. Because I know when I was going up to put those slides up, I wanted to make sure it was the best foot I could possibly put forward.
Right. Well, you don't want to be wrong, but I think that's where actually thinking of it as like, this is what worked for me. And this is an example from my house that worked. This is a way that I organize my code in my space. Doesn't that take a lot of pressure off too? So of not having like, I am right and I'm an authority that's saying that this is the right way. Like, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I don't even like that. Like, I try and frame a lot of the things that I talk about as like, here's a thing that works for me really well.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll work for you too. Let me know.
Yeah.
Yep. That's how I give it.
Up until really about like 2 years ago, I felt like that was the expectation that was like put on people, is like to say the right thing.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a lot of teams where that is an unspoken requirement, and that's something that we should examine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because even within a team, like, here's a thing that works for me, or here's a thing that worked on my last project, is very different from saying something like, well, industry best practice is to do X, right? And I think that, like, you get to a certain level of experience, and people expect you to say things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, in my experience, the best way to do it is blah. Which, you know, I mean, is not actually a super useful statement, because your past experience may or may not be directly applicable to the thing you're looking at right now, no matter how experienced you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's much more friendly to a range of experience levels to say things like, well, this worked for me on this project. Let's talk about whether it could work here.
Right. Yeah.
I really like that.
I do. It's so hard because like your human nature is to try and boil things down into a simple binary.
People would love to have a list of rules. I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yep.
This is a problem. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to come up with these questions that you can ask that will move you in the right direction without giving you rules, that will move you in the direction of finding the rules that work for you. Because rules themselves, people really, really, really want them. But they're always misused. They're always misunderstood. And what you really need are the questions that led you to those rules in the first place. That's what people really want. Although maybe that's not what they are asking.
The Steve Jobs approach.
Oh, no. Does that mean I have to start wearing black turtlenecks? I hate turtlenecks.
And New Balance shoes and the jeans.
But yeah, I mean, I think that it really is like, it's one of those things where people are very hungry for guidance, but we've been giving them the wrong kind of guidance. We've been trying to give them rules when what we really need to do is give them questions to help them develop their own judgment.
Right. Like when I was coming up, I thought everything, there was a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And I've been slowly, sadly, figuring out that it's not all black and white and it's not all just like logic. I've always treated programming as like, well, they wrote this and it's just logic, so I should be able to understand this. And it's been a long road to come to this conclusion, like kind of like what you're talking about. And it's like, this has been enlightening for me. It's like, you are going to solve your problems your own way. You're your own person. And you're going to think about things differently. And I really like the analogy of like, this is your house and this is how you work or you live in your house.
Right. And no one would tell you like, you know, in order to be a proper human being, you have to set up your house this way.
Exactly.
Yet, we feel comfortable telling people in order to be a professional developer, you need to set up your code this way. And I think that those are very similar statements. And we should really examine a lot of these like should statements that are all over the place when you're talking about software and think about whether or not they're actually serving us in our mission of doing more things with tech, right? Like overall, my mission here is for people to be more effective with code so that we can do more interesting things with it. Like, I'm tired of, you know, I live in the TV show Silicon Valley, essentially, right? So I'm surrounded by these companies that are solving these little tiny problems, and I'm tired of it. I want us to solve bigger ones. And in order to do that, we need to get better at coding. We need to get better at managing code over time. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Because it's not going to scale otherwise. So we are out of time. We are going to have you on the podcast again, because I don't think we got to, about 15% of the things that we wanted to talk about?
Oh, we are over time, aren't we?
Yeah, but thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on and talking with everybody. Can you drop real quick your Twitter handle so that if people want to have follow-on discussion, they can reach out to you that way, or preferred means of contact?
Yeah, no, Twitter is probably best. My Twitter is Sarah May, SARAHMEI. And that's mostly where I am.
All right. Well, fantastic. As always, feel free to reach out to us too. I'm Cowboy D on Twitter. And you're, what are you, Rob?
Rob Del 12.
Rob Del 12. All right. Yeah, it's a wrap. Thank you so much, Sarah. And we'll see you in the ether. And hopefully we'll have you on the podcast again sometime.